Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about all the ways we're spending more time online lately. From students taking classes online to video chatting with family and friends. And with us today to talk about it, Beth Wendt. She's a senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. We call it DOIT. With us for the first time, actually the second time, she brings 20 years of experience and a love for creative problem solving. So great to have her with us. Have you tried out something new on the internet lately? Maybe video calling, maybe doing a yoga class online. Have you tried digitizing some of your important documents to have them more handy when filling out online forms? Are you having tech problems? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Beth Wendt, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me today. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine. You know, a lot of us might be missing seeing some family members or friends right now, maybe just missing seeing real people. But there are some options to connect with those people virtually, and a lot of people have been trying those out. I have been on Zoom, Skype, WebEx, Microsoft Teams, Google Meet, and FaceTime. There are more out there. So for listeners who have never done something like a video call, what's it like? Do you think it feels like more of a connection maybe than just a phone call?
Yeah, well, I think everybody has been, or quite a few people have been introduced now to the world of video conferencing and using apps like Zoom and all of the different messaging services that are out there. It's new to a lot of folks, but some of us who, especially those of us who work in the tech world, have been using these things for a long time. So it's nice to have some of our friends and family on board now with using some of these technologies that we've been kind of recently inundated with.
Yeah, and it does, I think, feel like more of a connection than just a phone call. Would you agree or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially having multiple people on a Zoom meeting, you know, if you can get together a group of family or friends, it's fun to be able to set up a view on your screen so that you can see everyone's faces at the same time. You can see what's going on in their house. And, you know, we all know communication isn't just the words you say, but it's the look on your face. It's your hand gestures. There's a lot more to it than just what you're saying. So being able to connect with somebody a little bit closer than just a phone call certainly makes the isolation a little bit less.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. I had a friend, I haven't checked back with him to see, but they were trying a Zoom meeting with family members from four different households for the annual Easter brunch kind of thing.
I bet a whole bunch of folks did that yesterday. last week, I had a similar experience with a bunch of my family that's scattered across the U.S. We had a Passover Seder last week, and I think there were probably a half dozen different households represented on the call, and it was great. It was great to see everyone's faces. There were kids around, running around, making noise. It felt like being close to family, and that was really wonderful.
Perfect. Well, we have so many choices. How do you choose the right one for your situation, be it work or school or social or whatever?
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with whoever you're meeting with and what they're comfortable with. At least that seems to be the way things are going right now. Somebody proposes we do this meeting, they send you a link, and suddenly you have to learn a new platform you haven't been exposed to before. So I think folks are asking a lot of questions about what's the best thing to use for what particular circumstance. So like you listed off earlier, Larry, the myriad different choices that are out there, Zoom is one that's particularly popular right now. I think they're positioning themselves to be the official online platform meeting sponsor of the pandemic. There are some drawbacks to certain applications, depending on what you're doing. So you got to be careful with what you're using, depending on what kind of information you're discussing. I know there's been a lot of media recently about Zoom and some of the security issues that they've faced, and I'm sure a lot of people have questions about that.
Yeah, they've been, I've seen some recent releases like yesterday that they were I think it was yesterday, where they were dealing with the security issues that have been addressed to them. And it's such an easy platform to use. I think that's the kind of the virtue of it. And it runs pretty smoothly most of the time.
It does. Yeah, it does. It's a very simple interface, very easy to use, kind of no frills. There's not a lot to it. So it's not as confusing as some of the other applications can be. It works pretty well. They also started off with their free trial version, allowing folks to have free meetings up to 40 minutes without purchasing a license. I think they've actually dropped that 40-minute limit now on their calls. So the free service you can use. So I think a lot of people jumped on board because they didn't have to buy licenses for it. And it was just real simple, easy to get started with. And it's great for family conversations, having a happy hour with friends, stuff like that. I'd be a little more concerned with using something like Zoom for more business type collaboration and communication. Especially if you're talking about any kind of confidential information or something that's restricted.
Yeah.
So the security measures on Zoom are maybe not quite as good as some of the other platforms.
We have some callers online with some questions. Let's take a call. Renee in Madison, it's your turn.
Good morning. Renee. Hi, I've got something positive to share and then a quick question. I'm an ESL teacher at UW. And we're using BBC Ultra. That's the platform that UW has. And it was a challenge to learn, but it was a fun challenge. Anyway, in my class, I ended up having inviting speakers. It was very easy. I even had my niece, who is a test participant in the vaccine trials out in Seattle, join us. And I don't think I would have done that before if I wasn't on a online platform. So it was really exciting for my students and very easy to do. Then my question is, I ask my students not to use their video when we're online because I'm worried about overwhelming the bandwidth. Is that a legitimate concern? My students really probably don't prefer to use the video anyway, but I like to have their video. So that's my question.
All right. Thanks, Renee, for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that we've experienced even with the bandwidth that we have at UW in trying to have work meetings is sometimes the video can really slow down the traffic, especially on the end of the person who's watching, because the connection is only going to be as strong as the weakest link. So turning off your video is certainly a way to save on bandwidth, to reduce the amount of data that you're trying to transmit and receive through your internet. It can really speed things up. It can help from any of the audio disruptions that you might have or disconnections, things like that. Or if you're trying to look at other windows at the same time, sometimes those can combat each other for resources.
Yeah, I can kind of second Renee's comments. I'm teaching a class, which I always teach, and at the UW, and I went to BB Collaborate as well, Blackboard Collaborate, and it's been very, very good. Frankly, I've been really surprised at how good, but the setup, I had to rely on a lot of people because I only had a week to put this together, and I know, and I use the Do-It folks a lot, and I'm sure people you know very well. You probably had a little extra on your plate in order to make this transition.
Yeah, at Do-It, I definitely need to give a shout out to our academic technology group. They forklifted about 9,000 courses online in about 12 days. So it was a Herculean effort to move the university to online instruction. But thankfully, we have a lot of very smart and helpful people at UW and IT all over the university who collaborated to make it happen. So right now it's a little rough, but they're working on improving, making things better every day.
Well, if I'd had to do it on my own, I'd probably still be trying to get it up. So I appreciate the help a lot. Michael in Bear Valley has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I live out in a rural area, and I've noticed since the shut-in, you know, things have really slowed down on our computer link, our Wi-Fi link. And my question is there any talk about improving the infrastructure for people in rural areas? I can't imagine how teachers are able to carry on in classrooms with kids that have very slow connections. And the other question that follows up on that is I was standing outside the other night looking up, and I saw a satellite go over, and then another one, and then another one, and I counted over 30 satellites, and there was a long string of them, and I've apparently, it's part of the Starlink program, which is supposed to give global access to Wi-Fi. And I was wondering if you knew anything about that or could talk about it.
Yeah. Beth?
Yeah, good questions. So I know as far as providing infrastructure out in more rural areas, especially Wisconsin has, you know, quite a few areas of the state that don't have great broadband coverage. But I know that... other than California, Wisconsin has had the largest effort in the last couple of years to expand that infrastructure than any other state in the union. So that's helpful. There has been progress made in that direction. And I know that, you know, one thing that internet service providers are doing right now, instead of spending the time to bury cables underground, they're not putting those through conduit. They're leaving fiber optics exposed to be able to run lines out faster to rural areas to skip over some of the infrastructure steps that they go through to speed up that process. But it does take a pretty large effort to get broadband access to some of those areas. As for the Starlink, I just read an article about that the other day. It's really neat. I know that it is. Let's see, they just launched a whole new batch of satellites last month. I think it's like their sixth launch that they've done recently. It's still in experimental phases, so nothing's been rolled out yet. But I think that's something we can look to in the future as a possible better solution for people in rural communities. You know, current satellite internet leaves a lot to be desired. The speeds are pretty terrible. There's a lot of latency, so this is certainly something that could improve that.
Well, Michael, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Tom and Wanakee will give you a chance now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I have two quick questions. One about VPN, if just for personal use at home, email, internet, browsing, and TV downloading or movies. And the second is regarding password security, and do you have any recommendations for password security software? Thank you.
Yeah, great questions. My friends in cybersecurity will appreciate that you brought this topic up. Password security is something that we really work on quite a bit at the university. One of the biggest things we like to hammer home with people is to not reuse passwords, meaning don't use the same password across multiple platforms. So if you have one that you have for your work credentials, don't reuse that same password for your email and then for your Netflix account and for your bank account and things of that nature. You're going to want to use unique passwords for the various services that you sign up for that require it. And I know that can be a real burden on people to remember all those passwords. And if you have to change them with any frequency, then to remember what you changed them to. Keeping track of, you know, dozens of different passwords is not really sustainable for most folks. But there are some applications out there that can help you with it. One of the things that I use frequently is called LastPass. That's like a password vault. What it does basically is it allows you to create a master password for the application. That's the only one you have to remember. And then as you log in and save passwords for various services, it stores them in an encrypted password vault on your laptop or your phone or whatever device you're using, so that when you want to log back into that service, the password vault can release that credential to the application that you're logging into. So highly recommend using some sort of a password vault service. Those are quite secure.
And that's last, L-A-S-T, pass?
Last pass. That's correct. Mm-hmm. L-A-S-T-P-A-S-S. That's the one I use, but there are so many other services out there that do similar. That's just one I'm very familiar with. And as for VPN, VPN is more traditionally used when you are trying to get from your computer at home to resources in another place, like at work or something like that. You have data or applications that are somewhere remote from where you're accessing them. And a VPN is something that people often use to create an encrypted or a secure tunnel between their machine and the machine they're trying to remotely access to help secure that data transfer. Having one at home can protect you in more of a sense that people can't get into your systems as easily. So it can act somewhat like a firewall to protect you from intrusion. If you are storing any sensitive data on your laptop or your desktop at home, you might want to use a VPN when you connect out to the internet to help secure that data.
Talking today about your computer and mine with our guest, Beth Wendt. She is a senior IT specialist with the Division of Information Technology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have her with us today. Natalie Guyette, our producer today. Tim Peterson, our on-air producer. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at online learning today, collaboration platforms, dealing with a slow computer, digitizing important documents, all kinds of things with our guest today, Larry Mueller here. Beth Wendt, our guest, worked in IT for nearly 20 years. She's with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Questions for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Now, let's take another call. Dan in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about remote desktop or some way to control someone else's computer to fix settings problems, that kind of thing. I'm talking about a Windows PC. I was trying to help another family member out of town set up Zoom. And there were all sorts of problems with the webcam and the microphone. So is there anything native to Windows 10 that can allow that kind of control, you know, remotely over the internet? Or are there separate applications that are better for that?
Yeah, so there is actually an application built right into Windows 10. It's called Remote Assistance. And the person on the receiving end of the help, if they want to request remote assistance from you, if they go into their start menu and just start typing remote assistance, it'll pop up a link to that application. They can open that application and they'd send you an invitation to remotely assist them on their machine through an email. When you receive that email and you click on the link, it will take you to a remote session that will allow you to remotely view and change settings on their PC. So it's a pretty simple way to do that. Built in, don't need to buy anything extra or install anything for it.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I didn't even realize that. Dan, does that help?
Yeah, are there limitations with that? I mean, are there advantages with separate applications? Or, I mean, can you get into the device manager and deal with, you know, hardware, device settings, that kind of thing?
Yeah, you can do everything just as if you were sitting in front of the machine.
All right. There you go, Dan. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Let's take another call. Polly in Plymouth, it's your turn. Hi, Polly.
Hi. I live in rural Wisconsin, and until 2 years ago when the Obama thing came through, the only internet that I could get was the satellite, and I was paying $130 for 30 gigs. Then when the Obama thing came through, I was able to get DSL, and they talked me into getting the highest, which was still half the price of what I was paying for unlimited, and it was very, very fast. But now, 2 years later, it is slowing way, way down, and I a lot of times get that spinning wheel and processing. When I called them, they said that the only way to solve it is if I would pay for faster internet, but yet I'm not getting what I want. Is that the truth, or is there something I can do on my computer?
Sure. Beth, have you got a response for that?
Yeah, absolutely. You really shouldn't need to upgrade the speed of the internet connection that you're purchasing from the internet service provider. But one thing you might want to think about is upgrading the router that the internet is connecting to in your house. Often after a few years of continuous use on those routers, they can start to lose power, essentially. And when they lose power, they lose signal strength. When you lose signal strength, things slow down. So you may be able to get your internet service provider either to replace that piece of equipment, or that's something you can also look into purchasing separately yourself. They're, usually in the $50 to $100 range for a new router that could really speed things up considerably for you.
Polly, does that help?
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for
the router. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. We got an email from Sue Ann in Sun Prairie who writes they've used Zoom several times on their Lenovo IdeaPad. Their problem is they can hear audio from other members off the meeting, but others can't hear them. And I assume she's, clicking her microphone on.
Interesting. So they can hear what's going on in the meeting, but nobody can hear them?
Yes.
Yeah, I know that's been a real struggle for people, not just on Zoom, but on any. I was having the same problem this morning when talking with your engineer, trying to get my headset to work properly with the particular application that we're using right now to talk on. So they all have different ways of switching between audio devices. Usually somewhere within the settings, it will ask you which device you want to use for your microphone, which device you want to use for your speakers. Sometimes if you're going back and forth between different video conferencing softwares, that can get changed and it won't change back, or you don't have the correct one selected. Maybe you have the correct speaker selected but not the correct microphone. That could be part of the problem, but there's so many different factors that could weigh into the voice not working. That's just a couple of things.
Yeah, there's a myriad things I think that can happen. More people are learning from home these days, and there's a lot of parents that are now helping their children to learn online with some help from their teacher. I was at a meeting this morning at early in the morning because one of the participants had a child that she had to work with later, sort of at normal times with her child's schoolwork. When you have that many people on board, it does impact the service we're getting, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. The loads that some of the major internet providers are talking about right now, as far as increased demand on infrastructure, has really gone up with not just kids doing school from home, but folks working from home, people using streaming services more often. So, we're watching more Netflix and Amazon Prime than we were before. So the combination of all those things at once really is slowing down the infrastructure as a whole. You know, we only have so much room in the pipe to push data through. And if everyone is trying to push so much data at once, it's not going to all get through very quickly. So I think I read somewhere that internet usage as a whole in, since March 1st is up 18%, which when you think about how much we use the internet, that is quite a bit.
Oh, man. Beth Wedd, our guest today, senior IT specialist with the UW-Madison Division of Information Technology, taking your computer questions. If you have an issue of one sort or another, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Give you a call, shoot us an email, and we'll get you going pretty quickly here. Another thing I thought you could talk us through, how to upload a document when filling out an online form. Sometimes you're filling out an application online and they, you know, maybe they need a copy of your driver's license, for example. Mm-hmm. How do you do that if you don't have a scanner?
Yeah, that is a good question. So one of the products out there right now that I've been using considerably is called Office Lens. It's a part of the Microsoft Office suite. So if you have Microsoft Word or Excel or PowerPoint on your home PC or on your work PC, that's an application that would be available for you to download on your phone, where you can capture a scanned image of a document and convert it automatically to a PDF file, which is a pretty secure and easy format to use for things like applications or just general secure document storage. You can also just take a picture with your phone if you wanted to. But some applications require that you upload something in a certain format. So I would say Office Lens or a product similar to that is a really good option for those types of things.
Yeah, I've used my phone quite a bit for images. Just push my finger on the image and pretty soon copy pops up and
yep.
you copy that and you take it where you want and hit paste and there it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very, very nice. Let's take a call here. We got Tom with us from Green Bay. Tom, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just had a quick question. I was wondering about what exactly causes aging laptops, tablets, computers to slow down as they get older. And is there a way to, you know, clean up your computer to make it a little bit faster? Without, you know, having to take apart the computer and replace certain components.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things that could contribute to it. Most often what I see slowing things down is some sort of malware or some piece of software that was installed on your laptop unbeknownst to you. And it doesn't necessarily have to be something that is detrimental to your computer in that it's not a virus that's stealing your data and sending it to someone, but there was some piece of software that you downloaded at some point in time that may have come with something attached to it, or it may have come with some add-on components that if you had just clicked through the standard install menu, you didn't even know were being installed on your machine. Often, you know, those things run in the background and start taking up resources unbeknownst to you. And a good way to get rid of those things, at least if it's not malware, if it's just an application that you didn't install and that you don't want there, is to go into, if you're on a PC, to go into the control panel. And there's generally a programs and features option in your control panel that will bring up a list of everything that's installed on your PC. You can go through that list and make some decisions about what should be there and what shouldn't. So that's one thing that I usually do when people are telling me their machine's slow is start from there.
What about the Mac then?
On the Mac, there's a similar add and remove programs section. I don't know off the top of my head where it is because I am not as familiar with the Mac OS. But I'm sure if you go into your main folder section and type in the search feature programs, it'll give you a list of anything with that name in it, any configuration settings that you can get to. Yeah. And then you just choose from that list where you go to see your programs that are installed.
And I also remember reading something, and I don't know if it was true or not, that Mac, Apple was actually slowing down older machines on purpose to get people to buy new ones. Was that just an urban legend?
Well, it wouldn't be shocking. You know, we've all seen what happens when you get the latest update for your iPhone and suddenly your battery starts draining really quickly. So, you know, I wouldn't put it past them to do something like that, but it's not something that I've ever seen like real hard evidence for.
Okay. Well, let's, Tom, thank you very much for calling. David in Menasha, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, David.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm not sure if your guests will have an answer for me, but I guess her opinion I would appreciate. So I've been seeing a lot of videos that have been taken down recently on the internet, like YouTube and Vimeo, that have been talking about the virus and like possible connections with the virus, and that's kind of like disagreeing with what mainstream media is saying. Do you know, or do you have any, like, or what do you think about those videos that are like being taken down?
Yeah, I know that at least Facebook and Twitter have both made statements, you know, I guess promising to remove content that promotes misinformation regarding the COVID virus. And I think that it really all depends on who's doing the vetting, who is the one who's making the decision on what's misinformation and what's not, and what is their source of information for making that decision. So it's really about knowing your news sources and doing vetting on your own to know what a reliable news source is and what isn't. And, you know, just being diligent about knowing where your information is coming from so that you're not consuming misinformation and also not perpetuating it by sharing it with others. There's certainly no way that they're going to be able to remove everything. The internet is so wide and vast, and there's so much content. But I think it's really incumbent on everyone to be deliberate about where they're getting their news from.
David, thank you. Appreciate it. Jason in Wausau, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jason. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add a quick comment regarding the user that called in about her DSL speeds being slow. One thing that I would probably recommend before you go out and purchase a new router would be to just hard line directly into the modem. And this goes for anybody on any kind of connection, really. If you plug a cable directly into your modem and bypass your wireless capabilities entirely and speed test that way, you'll know whether or not the provider is actually giving you the kind of speed that you're supposed to be getting without the whole wireless aspect in play. There's a very large DSL provider in Wisconsin right now that's having a lot of infrastructure problems with their copper cabling rotting and causing a lot of serviceability issues that they're not really able to repair. A lot of people know who they are, so I won't name them. But, you know, that would be one step before you go out and spend $100 on a new router to try and troubleshoot something that the router might not fix. And also, if you have a current router, you can update the software in that router. A lot of times the router issues can be caused because of the firmware getting out of date. So before you go out and spend something, in my professional opinion, I would do those two things first. And if those still aren't solving the problem at that point, then maybe, yeah, you want to go out and try a new router. But at least those are some free things that you can try before you go out and spend any money.
Yeah. Well, Jason, thanks for calling. Beth, a comment.
Yeah, I think Jason's right. That's a good point. You know, there are things you can do to try to improve the performance of your current router. You can certainly update the software or the firmware on it. Sometimes just rebooting your Wi-Fi router will make things go faster. A lot of people don't ever do that. They just let it run all the time. And I've noticed sometimes when things slow down, if I also have a separate piece of equipment that my internet comes into. So I've got a router and then a Wi-Fi router as well. So I reboot both of those and then suddenly my connection is running much faster. So I know that, you know, the old joke, did you try turning it off and turning it back on again?
It's funny because it's true. Oftentimes that'll fix the problem. But updating firmware, updating the software version of the router is also a possibility, something you can do to help speed things up. Many other things that you can do before you have to spend money.
Yeah, that's for sure. But just go in and turn the router off and turn it back on again, huh?
Yeah. Some of them don't have a power switch on them. If they don't, you can really just unplug it, leave it off for 5 seconds, plug it back in, wait for all the lights to come back on. Once all the lights are back on, then you can retest your connection.
Do you lose anything when that happens?
I mean, no, you shouldn't lose anything. You just lose your connection.
You just lose the connections. You don't lose everything else.
No. That's certainly not the way you want to reboot your computer, but sometimes that's how you have to reboot a router if they don't actually have a power switch on them.
All right. Let's, and Jason, thanks again. Good comments. Deb in Plymouth, it's your turn now. Hi, Deb.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate the show. I heard you talking about remote assist. So I have a PC, but I have a friend who is having trouble figuring out how to put Skype on her MacBook Air and wondering if I would be able to help her, whether a MacBook Air would have something similar to that and if I could do it with a PC going to her Mac.
Yeah, I don't think you can use the remote assistance utility. You'd need, you know, the one that's built into the Windows PC. You'd have to use some sort of a third-party application to do it. And it would be something that you would likely need to install on both computers. So it might be harder to do that than it is to just install what you're trying to get done. It's sometimes really difficult to get a Mac and a PC to play nicely together. Or to get them to use the same software for things. So it may be a little tricky, but I would suggest just doing a little Google search for remote assistance PC Mac. And there's probably a whole long list of different applications that you can choose from. I'm sure many of them are free utilities that you can try out. I don't have any to recommend off the top of my head, but you won't be able to use the native utility.
And the standard on Mac, or what you get on Mac, is FaceTime.
Yeah, FaceTime is really more just for the video calling. You can likely, I don't know if you can share your screen through FaceTime now. If you could share your screen, then at least you could see what was on the other person's screen. You may not be able to control it, but you could see it. So maybe then you could walk them through the steps.
Deb, have you got a...
They have a PC.
Okay. Of course you do.
I'll try to call her and see if I can talk her through finding the Skype app. She's having trouble with that, but I think she should be able to download Skype on her Mac.
Yeah,
should be able to.
You may want to, I don't know if this would help, but if you could find, a link online to where you get the download, copy that link into an email and send it to her. She should just be able to click on that link and it'll take her right to where she would download it. You just want to make sure it's the download for Mac and not for PC.
Oh, that's a good idea. Very good idea. Deb, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Talking with Beth Wendt of the Division of Information Technology at UW-Madison about your computer and software. Great to have her with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today here on the Ideas Network and talking online learning, collaboration platforms, and a whole bunch of things with our guest, Beth Wendt, Senior IT Specialist with the UW-Madison Division of Information Technology. Questions? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Pete in La Crosse up next. Hi, Pete. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for this show. This is great. I just have a comment on scanning documents. We've had a lot of this with people needing to scan in licenses and things. if you have a smartphone, iPhone, or I think any Android also, in the Notes app, there is a scanner already present on the phone. If you open up a new Notes, there will be a series of little things along the bottom. One is the camera. And if you tap the camera, it'll give you a series of options, one of which is to scan a document. You just hold the phone over the document, it takes the scan, and then it saves it in your note file. And it saves it as a PDF, so you can send it out any way you want. So I just wanted to add that the apps work great, but you already have it on your phone if you have that.
Oh, Pete, I didn't know that either. Beth, comment, that works, eh?
Yeah, I was not aware of that one. I wonder if it's one of the newer updates on the iPhone that has added that to the notes function, but I'll have to try it out. Thanks for the tip.
Yeah, thanks very much for the tip, Pete. Appreciate it. Well, Mark in Oregon up next. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
I'm in the process of reviewing how I take care of my router and my modem for my home computer. I've got a router and a modem combination that was supplied by the phone company. And I was rather naive, went to Best Buy and bought a router, but now I find out it's a little more complicated because the router doesn't just plug right into the wall. There's an RJ11 phone jack, and it's an RJ45. Do I need to use equipment that's provided by the phone company, or can I replace it with my own?
Beth, what do you think?
Yeah, generally you can put your own router in place. It really depends on the internet service provider and how they're bringing that connection into your house. So if they're bringing it into your house in a way that requires you to have a specific RJ11 or RJ45 connection between where the internet terminates in your house and the router, you just need to make sure that you are using the right type of cable to connect that router up to the termination point for your internet. Oftentimes, though, internet service providers will do some pre-configuration on the modem/routers that you get from them. So I would suggest giving them a call and asking if there's any specific configuration settings that you would need to put on the router that you purchased in order to make sure that it works with your internet service provider.
All right. Mark, does that help?
It does help, but I've got an additional follow-up if possible.
Okay.
So it's the termination point where the plug goes to the combination router. Modem is an RJ11, and so if I would replace the equipment, is it hard to find a combination router modem that has an RJ11 interface?
No, it shouldn't be difficult to find one of those.
All right. There you go, Mark. Thanks very much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Terry called us from Dubuque. Couldn't stay online, but she wanted to let our caller know who asked about Skype that she's part of a group that uses Zoom. And guests have both Macs and PCs, and they're able to screen share without any difficulty. So that may be another option for our earlier caller, Beth.
Yeah, the screen sharing functions in most of these video conferencing apps are really helpful, especially if you're trying to see what somebody else is seeing or you want to help them with something and you're not sitting in front of their computer with them.
Sue emailed us about her 10-year-old Mac computer. It's running a Mac operating system, like 10.6.8, I guess, with 3 gigahertz core, 4 gigabytes of memory. When she tries to open many emails, such as real estate listings, she gets a message saying she can't open it unless she updates the newer version of Google Chrome on Firefox. But if she tries to update, download, or install these new versions like Firefox, she sees a message saying her computer can't do it. Does that mean she needs to buy a new computer?
No, it probably means that she needs to update the version of the Mac operating system that that computer is using. So as the PC manufacturer, or excuse me, as computer manufacturers like Apple or Microsoft, you know, they make these operating systems that run your computer. Then the application manufacturers make software that runs on that operating system. Sometimes in order to get the latest version of a piece of software, you also need to have the latest version of the operating system that's on your computer. Now, some computers are not going to be new enough to upgrade to the latest and greatest version of the operating system, but they need to be several generations old in order to hit that threshold. So if it's anything that was made in the last 5-6 years, generally you can get the latest version. Mac may be a little bit different than PC in when they make those old versions of hardware obsolete, but I would say go into your Mac software update utility, get the latest version of the Macintosh operating system downloaded and installed on your machine, and you should have far fewer problems with updating software then.
So there you go, Sue. I hope that works for you. Give it a try and see what happens. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Along with all of this, Beth, are you getting, are other kinds of computer problems showing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have no shortage of computer problems to troubleshoot these days. I'm doing it all over my house, too, working from home full time and getting my kids through online school full time right now. And luckily, they're pretty computer savvy, so they're able to figure out a lot of it themselves. But, I feel like I'm troubleshooting nonstop these days.
David in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, David.
Yeah, good morning. I have a iPhone, and I also have a laptop. My emails are going from my iPhone to my laptop, and I don't really need them on there. How can I disconnect the two to be different entities?
So your emails are showing up in both places?
Correct.
And you don't want them on your laptop? You only want them on your phone, or do you, the reverse?
Correct. Don't
want them on your phone.
I don't want them on my laptop.
Oh, on your laptop. Okay. You don't want them to download on the laptop, but you want to keep them on the phone. What do you use for checking your email on your laptop?
I don't. I don't even use a laptop for emails. I got my home computer is what I do for that.
Okay.
My Gmail, I just check my phone because I have very few Gmails coming in.
Okay, but your Gmail is still going to your laptop and you don't want it to do that?
Correct.
I see. Okay. Do you, I'm not sure where it would be showing up that you don't want it to on the laptop if it's not something you generally use, but often when you have your email set up, there's an option to either download the mail or to leave it on the mail server. So not knowing what you're looking at your email in, you'll need to go into the settings of whatever email client that is and tell it to leave those messages on the server rather than downloading them locally. So they'll continue to go to your phone if you leave that setting alone on your phone, but if you change it on your laptop, it'll stop downloading those to your laptop.
All right. I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling, David. Appreciate it. Did that help? David, are you there?
Thank you.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Just wanted to mention that we are in our spring membership drive, and we'll be talking about the spring membership drive from time to time as we move along through this week. It's a different kind of drive than what we normally do, but I hope you'll listen in when we're talking about that the drive and so forth. We're, it's it makes a big difference. I hope, and I'm pretty sure it does. WPR makes a difference in your day, keeps you connected with news and culture from nearby and far away. Members make up the biggest share of funding for WPR. So I hope you'll make a gift today for the programs that you count on, not only for yourself, but for your entire community as well. It's easy to do. You can give at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Or you can go to WPR.org. That's WPR.org and make your contribution there as well. Giving is easy. It'll only take you a minute or two, and certainly during our fund drive, it's so important that we do this. So if you're enjoying the program you're hearing today or all of the programs you hear, why not give right now? Go to 888-202-2552 or go online to WPR.org and make your contribution. Larry Mueller here. Beth Wendt, our guest, she's going to be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we will be back. You stay with us. We'll be back after the news. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here and talking today with Beth Wendt, Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She has 20 years of tech experience, talking about a variety of things, connecting in the digital world, whether you can learn to see familiar faces over a video chat, maybe you've got a problem with your computer, whatever it is, I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Call quickly, we'll get you on fairly soon. John in Madison, though, has a question, and let's go there. Hi, John.
Yes. Hi. My old computer. I have a Mac laptop, and it has real problems. I'm getting a new Mac, new laptop, and I want to be able to use the same email on the new Mac, and it seems to be a problem with that. How do I do that?
Okay.
Yeah.
Beth.
Pretty simple. Yeah. Pretty simple to do that. Most email services now, all the messages are stored up on the email server. So in order to connect to it, you can basically on your new machine, you just need to configure it to use the same email account that you were using on the previous one. But there's going to be a list of settings that you need to go in and configure on the new Mac in the email application. Generally, the best way to figure out what those settings are is either to look in the same application on your old machine or to go to your internet service provider, or your email provider's documentation, and do a quick search for email configuration settings. That'll generally tell you what you need to set up on the new machine in order to get it to connect back up to your mail account.
Ah, John, does that help?
Yes, it is. I recorded this so I can replay it. Thank you very much.
Great.
Record it. Well, I tell you what, you know, there's also, another way to do it, if you missed part of our show or you just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of our broadcasts. You can search by topic or date, and they go back for years and years. Or, like John, if you want to record a piece of it, why, just you can go ahead and do that as well. Thanks, John. Let's take another call. Sean in Sparta, it's your turn. Hi, Sean.
Hi. How's it going today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Well, I have a question about, I've been getting advertised, you know, on Facebook and so forth about, you know, devices for, you know, for, this is hotspot. I'm familiar what a hotspot is, but it says free internet. I thought, well, but you have to pay for it somewhere along the line. And I just was wondering if this is it's pulling my leg or, you know, because I would really like to, because on my phone, I use a hotspot to get on the internet. And I would like to come up with a way where, you know, if I could use a hotspot to get free internet, that'd be fine. But I'm just curious if your guest has heard anything about this.
All right. And Beth, maybe for those who may not be familiar with hotspots, before you answer Sean's direct question, what are hotspots?
Yeah, well, a hotspot is, it's basically when you take your cell phone and you turn it into a device that allows you to connect something else to the internet. So we all have an internet browser on our cell phones that allow us to, or on our smartphones that allow us to get out and do things on the internet. And that uses your data connection through your phone plan. So that'll use generally your 4G or your 3G, depending on where you are, your cell phone service in order to transmit internet data. What the hotspot does, it's basically just a setting on your phone that you turn on that allows you to, say, take your laptop or your desktop at home, connect it through your phone to the internet so that you're using your data plan in order to connect your PC to the internet rather than using something from an internet service provider like DSL or cable internet or something like that that comes hardwired into your house. I know a lot of folks have been utilizing this when they don't have reliable internet service at home. If they're in a rural area that does get decent cell phone coverage but doesn't have DSL or cable internet or one of the other broadband options available, a hotspot can be a good solution for that. One thing to keep in mind is you are using the data charges on your phone. So if your cell phone has a limit to the amount of data you can use per month before they start charging you for it, this will go against that limit to the amount of data you can use.
And what about Sean's comment about the advertising that say you don't need a free internet, you don't need a subscription?
Yeah, I would be dubious of anything telling you get free internet. I know that some service providers are opening up, internet usage to new customers for free, especially students who may not have had internet service previously, who need it for online education. Those are generally reliable. But anything that's saying get this hotspot and you have free internet, I would think twice about. It just sounds a little bit too good to be true.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it. Bernard in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, so my question is, after this work that's being done by technology professionals, especially the support professionals that are in the trenches, do you think the way that they're revered through by other people in enterprise, you know, instead of being a redheaded stepchild, do you think they'll have more respect with regards to some of the work that they're doing?
Well, what do you think, Beth?
Well, you know, I've heard a little bit in the office, just because it does, you know, feel like most of the world is resting on information technology's back right now as far as continuing to function. So it does feel like we've suddenly become a lot more important than we were considered before. I know folks in IT, we kind of fly under the radar often and nobody really knows we exist unless something goes wrong. And that's kind of the way you want it when you work in IT. You don't want people beating down your door because that means something is broken. So generally we kind of like to fly under the radar and be unnoticed because that means things are working properly. But lately we've become a lot more popular as far as, you know, people reaching out to us quite a bit more than they were before. And not just when things are broken, but when they want to learn how to do something new. And I think that maybe organizations are starting to see, more of the value that IT brings to their organization rather than IT being a cost center. The view is maybe changing where IT is becoming the enabler of work. And I hope that changes some attitudes towards, folks appreciating the work that gets done for them and appreciating the fact that they have a lot of folks working behind the scenes to make sure that they can do their jobs.
Yeah. Bernard, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, it was certainly brought home to me here a few weeks ago when I had to suddenly go online with my class in about 1 week's time, and all of the help I got from the IT folks that do it were, and elsewhere, much appreciated. Well, Cynthia in Mission Vale, California, up next. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I have a question about transferring my internet access. For a long time, I used AT&T, and their companion email is Yahoo. And I lately switched over to Cox and would like to use Gmail. But I'm concerned that it, but I haven't yet disconnected my AT&T, so basically I have both. And the reason I haven't done that is because I'm concerned that if I disconnect the AT&T, I'll lose my email folders in Yahoo. So my question is, can I access Yahoo independently of AT&T?
Yeah, is it a Yahoo email address that you're using?
Yeah, well, it's an AT&T, but it's on it. It's AT&T address. So it's my email address is .att.
Okay, so it's an AT&T.com or an AT&T.net. But Yahoo is what you use in order to be able to access the email. You use a Yahoo Mail account for that.
Right, and I can actually access it by going in through Yahoo.
Gotcha.
If I want to.
Yeah. So. You're probably going to want to reach out to AT&T to see if canceling your account with them for internet impacts your access to that email account. If it's through Yahoo, that leads me to believe that the email account is independent of the actual internet access that they provide you. And if that's the case, then you should be able to keep everything that's in that mail. You should still be able to access it once you've closed your account with AT&T, that email account will stay available for you. But you're certainly going to want to reach out to them to make sure that that's the case.
Okay, well, I'll do that then. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, you're welcome. Cynthia, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Terry in Washington, D.C. called but wanted to take her answer off the air. What are some suggestions for audio-only conferencing using just smartphones for a group of 10 people, some of whom have Androids, others have iPhones? They've tried a basic phone conference call, but that limited the number of members, and FaceTime audio only works for iPhone users.
Yeah, the application I use most for something like that is called WhatsApp. That's WhatsApp. That is an application where you can do chat, so you can text chat folks. You can also do video calling and you can do audio calling through it. It's a free application. You would need to download and install it on any device that is trying to use it. So if somebody is calling in from their phone to the conference, they'll want to download and install it on their phone. They also have versions that you can download and install on your laptop or an iPad or a tablet device like that. Enables you to do all of those functions through a free application that works on both platforms. It's very simple to use. It's also encrypted, which means it's one of the more secure collaboration and communication tools that's out there. So that's one that I definitely recommend to folks if they're trying to do that between different operating systems.
WhatsApp. W-H-A-T-S.
WhatsApp.
Yeah, APP. All right. That works for sure. Karen emailed to ask for a computer suggestion for an elderly person who uses an iPad only for FaceTime. Older people have slower reflexes and they can't double click on things as easily. Are there computers that are better for elderly use, do you think?
Yeah, well, I would certainly think that a tablet like an iPad or something of that nature would be an easier thing to use for somebody who either has slower reflexes or may have any kind of accessibility issues or vision problems or things like that, because the interface is very simple. There's not a lot of typing or clicking. You know, you tap on things once and they open. There are laptops that are kind of both, where it can act as a laptop and a tablet. If you want something that has a standard keyboard that acts more like a laptop would, but also still has the touchscreen functions, which makes it easier to navigate for folks who may have issues with their motor function. I use one, actually. I'm on one right now. What is this thing called? Dell makes it. I can't even remember.
Dell makes it. Okay.
Yeah, it's a Dell. It's a, you know, kind of a laptop tablet hybrid. There's a whole bunch of them out there. That they have full size keyboards on them. They have the touchscreen on the monitor, so it's easier to use. You don't have to click on it like you would with a mouse. They're pretty simple to navigate and pretty powerful machines.
It's not one of those jelly type ones that don't have hard. Those are awful, I think, and for an. For anybody, that at least for me, they're hard to use. So the hard case, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, and this is it looks like a laptop essentially, but it's got a touchscreen monitor on it, so that might be a good option. Also, you can get a touchscreen monitor for a desktop machine as well if a touchscreen is easier to utilize for somebody with issues with motor function. The Windows 10 operating system supports touchscreen monitors. So if you wanted a bigger monitor than something that's on a laptop, you can get one of those for a desktop with Windows 10 and use the touchscreen functions right on there.
Jim in Madison has a question. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have a question regarding getting my email service onto my iPad. For some reason, the iPad's about 3 to 4 years old, and I have a email service through a major university, and I've never been able to get or send my email through the iPad. And it seems like I should be able to go to settings and reconfigure that. But I didn't know if your guests had an idea on perhaps what my problem might be.
Yeah. Do you know what email service your university provides? Is it Office 365?
That I do not know.
You don't. Okay. So it really depends on the email service that they're providing to you. I do know that some email services like Office 365 don't function properly with older versions of the Apple Mail client. So if you're using Apple Mail on your iPad and it's an older iPad, it may have that older Apple Mail version. If that's the case, oftentimes it needs to be switched. There's a configuration setting in there where you switch between basic authentication and modern authentication. You'll need to turn the modern authentication functions on that Apple Mail client in order for it to connect to something like Office 365.
All right.
I'll try that. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Dale in River Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Dale.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm trying not to be too much of a conspiracy theorist here, but in this day of us being aware of other countries, other regimes who are trying to hack into our systems, I'm a fan of the adage that with ease comes disease. How much should we be concerned that other countries, et cetera, are using this as a time to put out apps that are very easy to download and use as a way to use kind of a Trojan horse to get into our systems, our online infrastructure?
What do you think, Bev?
Yeah, I can certainly see that being a possibility. I know that the another old adage out there is never let a good crisis go to waste. So I'm sure that there are folks who are looking at a crisis as an opportunity, where people are looking for easy, fast and cheap solutions or free solutions to communicating with others or collaborating with others, that there could be things out there that you need to watch out for, you know, like Trojan horse applications that are out there, and they look really appealing to folks, but may have something behind the scenes that is not quite so appealing. So I would just encourage people to be diligent about the sources that they're getting things from. Do your research. Look at reviews online of applications that you're, you know, hoping to use. Read about them, and be informed about what you're putting on your machine.
Yes, good points. Thanks very much for that comment. Other callers, we had a listener question via email about how to send a larger video via Gmail, one that's bigger or longer than normally allowed.
Yeah, I don't remember what the limit is on the size of file you can send via Gmail. I can't remember off the top of my head what it is, but if you're trying to send a larger video via Gmail, it probably won't function properly. A couple of different ways you could do it. You could use a video edit software to break it up into multiple videos, so you can create multiple files that are of smaller size, break it up and send it that way. Or another thing that would probably be easier to do is to upload it to YouTube and then send somebody a link to that file. So you can create a YouTube account for yourself or Vimeo or any one of the other video sharing platforms. You can make that account private so that other people can't see what's in it unless you invite them to it. And then you can share the link to that video with whoever you want to be able to see it. It's generally a good way to share something that's too large to send via email.
Yeah, or Box.
Box could be an option, absolutely. Any of the other cloud storage softwares, you could use Google Photo. There are lots of different ways you could just share a link to where the video is stored somewhere online, yeah, rather than sending the large file.
Yeah, I wind up, I have a lot of large audio files to send. I often use Box just because it's an easy way to do it.
It is handy.
It is very handy. And Beth, you're kind of handy too. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thanks so much.
Yeah, of course. Happy to join you. Thanks a lot, Larry. Have a great day.
You as well. Beth Wendt is a senior IT specialist with the UW-Madison Division of Information Technology, or Do It. Well, here we are in our spring member drive, and a little different kind of drive this time around, but you know what? We still make a difference. WPR makes a difference in your day. It keeps you connected with news and culture from near and far away, and a lot of practical information as well. I hope you'll make a gift today for the programs you count on for yourself and the community. You can give at 888-202-2552, 888-202-2552, or do it online at WPR.org. That's WPR.org. And thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.